Salim Tamari with a virtual return to Jaffa. I am grateful for Hanan and her great contributions with these special interviews. Thank you, Hanan, very much. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Radio is hiring. We are currently accepting applications for the position of membership coordinator. The membership coordinator is responsible for planning and developing KBOO's fundraisers and on-air membership drives, data entry, working with major donors, direct mail campaigns, and community outreach. This position is 25 hours per week. For the full job description and instructions for applying, go to our website at kboo.fm/membership-hire or send your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org. Applications are due by midnight, Friday, May 19th. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Apano's Voices of Change, Deepening Ties, Growing Power, on Saturday, May 20th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Great Room in Beaverton. It's an annual gathering of AAPI community to celebrate the past year, talk about future hopes, and be together. That's Apano's Voices of Change, Deepening Ties, Growing Power, on Saturday, May 20th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Great Room, 15900 Southwest Regatta Lane, Suite 105 in Beaverton. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Policy for the People, a show that explores the public policies that can lift up all Oregonians. This show is a collaboration between KMUZ Radio and the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I am your host, Juan Carlos Ordóñez. Over the past 4.5 decades, we have seen economic inequality return with a vengeance. We're living through a new gilded age, comparable to the one at the turn of the 20th century. The first gilded age was the age of Rockefeller and Carnegie. Ours is the age of Bezos and Knight. The return of extreme wealth inequality is the result of public policy choices, not least decisions on how we tax the super rich. In this episode of Policy for the People, we look at two different policies on how we tax, or don't tax, the wealthy. In the first segment, we examine the tax break known as Opportunity Zones. Bennett Minton of Tax Fairness Oregon explains why this is a tax break where only the rich can play. In the second segment, I speak with my colleague from the Oregon Center for Public Policy, Daniel Hauser, about a recent attempt by some Oregon lawmakers to fast-track a repeal of the estate tax, the only real mechanism we have in Oregon for taxing extreme wealth. Stay tuned. This summer, a Ritz-Carlton hotel and condominium will open up in downtown Portland. Its developers call it the first ultra-luxury structure in the Pacific Northwest. But the Ritz-Carlton, where $7 million only fetches a standard condo, is more than an enclave for the super rich. It is also a tax shelter for wealthy investors who can take advantage of the tax break known as Opportunity Zones. Opportunity Zones are a set of tax breaks created by the Trump tax plan passed in 2017. They became Oregon tax breaks, piling on to the federal tax breaks, because the state's tax code often connects automatically to the federal one. The Oregon legislature had the power to say no, but it failed to do so. Opportunity zones encompass three different tax breaks for capital gains income, the profits from selling investments in things such as stocks, businesses, and real estate. To benefit, you must invest in opportunity funds that then invest in real estate projects or businesses located within the areas designated as opportunity zones. The profits reaped by investors get taxed at a lower rate than they normally would or escape taxation altogether, depending on how long the money is invested. Although sold as a way to help distressed communities, opportunity zones aren't doing that. Instead, they simply make the rich richer, says Bennett Minton. Bennett is a member of Tax Fairness Oregon, a network of volunteers who advocate for a rational and equitable tax code. Before moving to Oregon, Bennett worked for many years on federal tax policy as a reporter, analyst, and lobbyist in Washington, D.C. As Bennett explains, the idea behind opportunity zones is not new.
The first time that Congress adopted these kinds of provisions, they were called empowerment zones. And this was in the wake of the Los Angeles riots following the trial of the police officers who beat Rodney King. So the idea is, yes, if we can get rich investors to sell whatever else it might be that they have, generally stock, and encourage them to put it into distressed communities, then that's a win-win. So Congress enacted that actually in 1993 in the first bill when Bill Clinton was president. Think tanks have been studying this idea for 30 years, and it's a scam. It doesn't work. And this iteration in particular is the most outrageous tax provision that I have seen, and I've been studying taxes since 1981.
The idea to create opportunity zones came from a Facebook billionaire, Sean Parker. When you're a founder of Facebook and you own a lot of stock, Parker said, you spend a lot of time thinking about capital gains. With the backing of other billionaires, Parker began lobbying Congress to establish opportunity zones.
In this case, what you had was a provision that was designed by people who were outside Congress, and they went to Congress and said, oh, let's do this. And when the Republicans wrote the tax bill in 2017, they didn't hold any hearings. They didn't vet anything that they were doing. It didn't do what it was intended to do, because its designers didn't really care. What they were interested in was, how can we avoid paying capital gain tax? I think they were motivated as well by, oh, well, let's do something for downtrodden communities. But that wasn't their primary motivation. The way that process worked, when Trump said, I got to have a tax bill by Christmas, the Republicans in Congress, frankly, they didn't care. They wanted a victory, and they got a victory. And of course, the victory was for rich people.
It was a victory for rich people because when it comes to opportunity zones, only the rich can play, says Bennett.
When we say only the rich can play, you've got to have capital gain sitting on the sidelines to do this. Most of us don't have that kind of money. If you look at the statistics on taxpayers, we're talking about the top, oh, maybe 5% of all taxpayers in the country have any kind of substantial gains that they could put into these kinds of investments in opportunity funds. And opportunity funds are run by the usual suspects, people who put together these funds and they pool the money. What we're talking about are big time money managers at law firms or investment firms, or individuals who have clients in one way or another who are very wealthy. And they can set up a qualified opportunity fund, which follows rules established by the Treasury Department. And then they go to work to market their fund. And so they will say, for example, we're going to help finance the Ritz-Carlton in downtown Portland. Would you like to play? But to play, you got to have $100,000. Generally, you've got to be what's called an SEC certified investor, which means that you have wealth of at least $1 million, not including your primary residence, and depending on whether you're married or single, income of a couple of $100,000. Needless to say, that's a pretty exclusive group of people who would invest, who also have the play money to do this. You've got to be very wealthy to play. You've got to be very wealthy to be a client of somebody who is running an opportunity fund.
Not only is Opportunity Zones a tax break that further enriches the rich, but there's no real evidence that it's fulfilling the goal of lifting up impoverished communities. Researchers who have looked into Opportunity Zones have found mixed, limited, or no effects on things like the number of job postings and the formation of new businesses in the areas designated as Opportunity Zones.
The parameters of what's called an Opportunity Zone are so broad that no investor need invest in a distressed community. They can invest in, as we have all seen, hotels, condos, marinas, self-storage facilities, all kinds of things that investors believe will produce a great return over any other thing that they might invest in and pay no tax. So it has nothing to do with investing in distressed communities. And in fact, it does not work for distressed communities because the opportunity to make money elsewhere is so much greater.
As we see so often with business tax breaks, Opportunity Zones is subsidizing projects that would happen anyway. And in some instances, as in the case of the Ritz-Carlton in downtown Portland, it's subsidizing projects that had already begun before Congress created the tax break, according to Bennett Minton.
So as we were doing our research then, we identified three projects in downtown Portland in which the investors had created a new entity. These were projects that were ongoing, and the Ritz was one of them. And after Congress passed Opportunity Zones, they dumped the interest in the project into a new entity. And because of the way Treasury wrote the rules, that was perfectly legal for the investors to create this new entity and take advantage of the Opportunity Zone tax breaks. So there was no there was no incentive to build this hotel or the Grand Stark Hotel, which is now open on Grand Avenue on the east side. And there was a third project called 11 West, which had already broken ground. And at that time, the investors, as I say, created a new entity so that they could take advantage of the tax breaks. So it did not have any incentive value for, oh, let's create a project that happens to meet the technical requirements of the Opportunity Zone law. It was just, oh, well, let's get some gravy on top.
All that gravy is expensive, sucking up resources that could otherwise go to fund schools, affordable housing, or other good uses for these public dollars.
The earlier estimates were a couple of billion dollars on the federal level and a few million on the Oregon level. But over time, that number has grown. And the Department of Revenue here now thinks that Opportunity Zones cost us about $16 million a year. What I believe is that that $16 million is for all years of the program. So we're now into 5 years, so that's $80 million. There are also discounts on what taxpayers have to pay in 2026. So if we were to disconnect from the provision, I believe the gain to the Oregon General Fund would be $111 million. And this comes from research that was undertaken by the congressional equivalent of our Legislative Revenue Office, the Joint Committee on Taxation. The new numbers that the Joint Committee came up with last year showed an 11-fold increase in the cost of the program compared to the estimate that they'd done 2 years before. So it just gets more expensive as we go along. And partly that's because investors have realized, wow, what a tax dodge. Like all other choices with our money, we're making a value judgment about where we're going to spend our money. And in this case, the legislature so far is choosing to spend it on the top 2 or 3% of investors putting in projects like the Ritz-Carlton instead of whatever else they might do.
In the current legislative session, there is a bill, House Bill 3039, that would end the Oregon version of the Opportunity Zone's tax break.
It simply requires that Oregon taxpayers who have invested in Opportunity Zone projects must pay regular income tax on those profits, both the ones that they sold back in 2019 or 2020 or whenever it is that they sold to put into the opportunity funds. And more importantly, in 10 years, when they begin to sell those investments, and under federal law, they pay no tax. That is a truly unknown liability because we just don't know how much money has been put into these funds and how much it will earn in capital gain when those investors sell. So we can't even guess at what the liability is for the general fund. To me, this bill is a no-brainer.
Will the Oregon legislature finally stop subsidizing the profits of wealthy investors? In 2020, a bill similar to HB 3039 died on the vine after a walkout by Republicans brought the legislative session to an abrupt end. As of this recording, Senate Republicans have begun a new walkout. Time will tell whether this time is different. Opportunity Zones is a big tax break for wealthy investors, but it pales in comparison to what Oregon's wealthiest households would get if some Oregon lawmakers got their way and eliminated the estate tax, the only real mechanism we have here in Oregon for taxing extreme wealth. I spoke with my colleague Daniel Hauser, Deputy Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, about a recent attempt to do just that. Daniel, last month, Oregon lawmakers tried pulling an interesting procedural maneuver. And I should explain that we're speaking the day after Senate Republicans walked out of chambers. So we're not referencing that. We're referencing a different procedural maneuver. And I'm wondering if you can explain what it was and why Oregonians should take note.
On tax day in April, we actually saw, as you referenced, Republican lawmakers attempt to bring a set of bills to the floor in both the House and the Senate. And in the House, there was a tragic effort to bring forward tax breaks for corporations, for the wealthy, and for the estates of some of the very richest people in Oregon. And what this gimmick kind of looks like is that they can call for a bill to be brought straight to the floor, right? That a bill can skip the usual process of going through committee hearings, allowing for public testimony, having the bill worked and evaluated by nonpartisan legislative staff. And instead, they tried to pull some of those bills straight to the floor so they could debate and try and push forward with their priorities. And unfortunately, a bipartisan group of lawmakers actually supported some of those measures in the House. I'm grateful, however, that a majority of the legislature did reject these tricks. However, it's a really prescient warning to Oregonians to guard against efforts to weaken and really undermine some of our more progressive and stronger tax provisions.
And one of those bills that was brought directly to the floor was an effort to repeal Oregon's estate tax. Is that right?
That is right. There was an effort to repeal really Oregon's main and strongest mechanism to try and tax the extreme wealth that permeates our state.
So we'll get to the details of the estate tax in a moment, but I want to flesh out what you just said now, that the estate tax is the main way we tax extreme wealth in our state. Can you give our listeners a sense of just how extreme wealth inequality is in Oregon right now?
Yeah, it's really bad. Today, three billionaires alone own more than twice the wealth of the bottom half of all Oregonians. So put another way, three guys own more than double the least wealthy, nearly a million Oregonians combined. And the value of the assets owned by just one of those billionaires, Phil Knight, tops the combined value of all the assets of the bottom half of all the state's or residents on his own. And it's not just a few really rich guys, although they certainly paint the extremes of this picture. The richest tenth of Oregonians own about three quarters of all the wealth in the state. So that leaves the bottom 90% of Oregonians share only a quarter of the state's wealth. So it's really clear that wealth is really concentrated at the top, and even more so in the very, very top handful of families.
What has caused such an extreme concentration of wealth?
You know, there's a lot of things that feed in to the way we've ended up with such an extreme concentration of wealth. I mean, we start from an economic system, a capitalist system that's really, you know, by default ensures that there is an ongoing concentration of assets and wealth in the hands of a small group of folks, right? I mean, it's kind of how the system's designed. And that's why we have governmental programs and taxes and policies that are designed to help restrain some of those downsides. Progressive taxation is an incredibly effective way to make sure that we're reining in the excesses of the systems that we've built. And, you know, tragically, progressive taxation in Oregon and nationwide have been eroded pretty significantly over the past few decades. And today, we're left with a tax system that proportionally asks more from the poor than the rich, where the poorest Oregonians pay a larger share of their income in taxes than the very richest Oregonians. And the rich aren't like accidental beneficiaries of the system. This wasn't something that just happened to them. It's something that they have been working for decades to make happen for themselves. And as you heard from Bennett earlier in the show, the Opportunity Zones tax breaks are a really great example of this. And that's just one example, right? There are countless other examples of how the rich have designed a system to really protect the concentration of wealth that they've accumulated over the years.
So let's talk about where the estate tax fits in all this. And maybe let's start by defining what the estate tax is.
Sure. The estate tax, it's a tax on the assets of an estate, right? All of the property, income, retirement accounts, what have you, that's worth more than $1 million when the person died. And depending on the size of the estate, the tax rate starts at about 10% and grows to about 16% if an estate finally gets up over $9.5 million. And people often talk about the need to have a wealth tax to target the extreme and egregious wealth inequality that we were just talking about. And while a wealth tax directly on the living assets of very rich folks is definitely worth discussing, Oregon does have a progressive wealth tax, but it only kicks in when people die. That's the estate tax. It's a once-a-lifetime check on this continued growth of the aristocracy. Now, we have a few other ways of taxing wealth in Oregon, but the property tax is really the biggest one. Unfortunately, it's also one that's relatively regressive, right? It is not a progressive one that targets the very richest households like the estate tax does. And the estate tax really is our strongest means of taxing wealth progressively in Oregon. And Oregon does have a history of taxing estates. We've been taxing estates since 1903. We have more than a century of experience taxing people's piles of gold when they die. And we don't stand alone in taxing estates either, right? The federal government has an estate tax in place today, although tragically it's been eroded and cut back for decades by the very same flawed arguments that we've heard brought forward by folks on the floor of the legislature just a few weeks back.
I'm wondering if you can say a little bit about how the estate tax works, who pays it?
Sure. As I mentioned, it's extremely progressive, which is great. I mean, that is a very positive feature of our estate tax, that the biggest estates are going to be paying higher rates, that people with very little assets when they pass, you know, someone who's got their only assets are a home worth $500,000 when they pass, their descendants or their children won't owe anything in the estate tax. In fact, in the last year we have data available, 2020, less than 5% of the people who passed away that year had an estate that owed the tax. For those that paid the highest tax rate of 16%, right, it was 50 people in 2020 who ended up paying those highest tax rates. So it is a progressive tool that focuses on the highest concentrations of wealth and really has no impact on middle-class families or low-income or working families. And I will say too, that there are, like, these are the estates after all of the other tax planning tricks have been deployed. One of the common means of doing this is to ensure that when the first spouse passes, that the trust that's set up makes it to where the estate tax threshold of that $1 million isn't really what they have to worry about. It's when the second spouse passes, then they are able to actually use a $2 million threshold. And this is a fairly common tax planning technique. So in practical terms, for a lot of people who end up having to owe the estate tax, $2 million in Oregon works as a threshold.
You hear a lot about the estate tax putting in danger family farms. People who have looked into it have never really been able to find farm owners who have been affected by the estate tax. What is the reality when it comes to how the estate tax affects family farms?
So Oregon's estate tax actually includes what's called a natural resource credit. And this is a credit for estates that are worth up to $15 million, right? So still fairly large estates. If they have farmland, forest land, or other qualifying natural resources, and they've been actually actively working it in their family for a set number of years before the person passes, and their descendants, the children who inherit this property, continue working on that family farm or forest for a set number of years after they pass, then there's a big tax break in the natural resource credit that really reduces any little bit of estate tax owed in Oregon.
So in other words, the estate tax is one of the few mechanisms, perhaps the only mechanism that we have for taxing extreme wealth here in Oregon. But even that mechanism has been weakened. There's ways to get around it and so on. So if lawmakers who tried pushing through legislation to get rid of the estate tax altogether had succeeded, what would it mean for ordinary folks?
Well, for ordinary folks, they would see no benefit, right? They're not paying the estate tax today. This wouldn't help them. You know, these very same families, however, rely on public services. There are so many important public services that Oregonians depend on that would be eroded, that would be, in some cases, cut back or eliminated entirely if we get rid of the estate tax. And the reason for that is the estate tax is one of the larger, it pales in comparison to the personal income tax, but one of the larger revenue sources that go into our budget, that go into the general fund of the Oregon state budget. In the upcoming budget period, the forecast is it'll raise over $500 million. Eliminating the estate tax, weakening it further, that pulls dollars out of our schools, out of investments in affordable housing, out of the very things that the ordinary Oregonians, people in our community, depend on to make it through the day and make it through the week. And I think the other part too is, you know, we're all working in this system of really extreme economic and wealth inequality, and eliminating Oregon's estate tax would only make it worse. There's a great quote from Warren Buffett around how he believes in keeping equality of opportunity. He said, "You don't get to be a quarterback because your father was a quarterback 20 years ago." And although the Manning family is doing everything they can to prove that anecdote wrong, I think for our economic system, we want to ensure that there is an equality of opportunity and that you don't get to end up at the top just because your parents were. The one other thing to keep in mind around what the impact of eliminating the estate tax is the impact on worsening and widening the racial wealth gap. The wealthy who held so much of the power and so much of the assets of our state are not just rich, they're also overwhelmingly white, right? And this is the result of centuries of racial exclusion and oppression, other forms of discrimination and racist policies. And data exclusive to Oregon isn't available to really tell you with fine detail how bad it is in Oregon. But nationally, the typical white household has about $187,000 in wealth, while the typical Latino family has $32,000, and the typical Black family has $14,000 in wealth, right? A tiny fraction of the wealth of the typical white household. And that doesn't even factor in how extremely high the wealth gap is when you really look at the richest, whitest households. So repealing the estate tax would mean we're giving a windfall for a small group of rich, white households, and we would be worsening racial inequality in the state by doing so.
Daniel, any final thoughts you want to share with us regarding the estate tax and these efforts to repeal it?
Yeah, at a time when we have such extreme wealth inequality, it's hard for me to imagine why lawmakers would want to prioritize, over all the other things they could be doing to improve the lives of Oregonians, why they want to prioritize this tax break for the rich and wealthy. They could instead be focusing on how can we make our state stronger and more vibrant? How can we help low-income families access childcare, afford the rent, strengthening our schools, things that can really help improve the outcomes for all Oregonians. Over a century ago, Oregonians made the right choice of putting into place a tax on inherited wealth. And I think this generation needs to rekindle that spirit. Not only do we need to defend our estate tax from these continued assaults, but we really need to establish other ways to tax extreme wealth. And I really think the well-being of this and future generations of Oregonians demand it.
Well, Daniel, thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure, Juan Carlos. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to Policy for the People. We will see you next
time. The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning into KBOO Portland.
Good morning, and welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. This week, Jeff Godsell revisits A Tale of Two Cities from 1935, while Matthew of KBOO's monthly bedtime story program, Gremlin Time, revisits a rock film classic. And in our DVD corner, we cover the new Criterion DVD of The Worst Person in the World, Joachim Trier's film from 2021. But first, Britta Gordon looks at the timely Learning to Skateboard in a War Zone If You're a Girl, Carol Deisinger's Oscar-winning documentary from 2019.
This week, I've decided to forego the veneer of objectivity, though I'll strive for it anyway, in a review of a lovely work by Carol Deisinger, a professor of film at New York University and one of my teachers when I